Okay, so hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Precision Microcast. Today we have a special guest, Cyrus Lloyd. You may know him as Silo's Garage on YouTube. And he's here to tell us about his new job, some projects, and some of the things he saw at IMTS.
Thanks for having me, Adam and Josh. It's great to be on. Excited to be the second guest, and hope we can make a fun episode here.
It's great to have you on, Cyrus. It was lovely meeting you at IMTS. IMTS felt like a bit of a surreal experience for someone who lives across on the other side of the globe. All my internet friends became real, and you are real. I just want to confirm and validate for the rest of the internet community that you're a real person. But it was lovely hearing about all of your precision interests and pursuits, and I think we'll have a great time exploring that on this episode of the Precision Microcast.
Okay, Cyrus, why don't you introduce yourself, your background, your education, and what you're doing now?
Yeah, so like Josh said, Silo's Garage is the internet handle that I use. Some of you may have seen my stuff, some of you maybe not. I have a YouTube channel where I've sort of documented over the last few years project that I've been working on, which is building a diamond turning lathe. I did that while I was in school. I'm graduated now. I work as a precision engineer up at a small company in Lafayette, Indiana, called ZS Instruments. And we can get into both of these projects, but yeah, basically precision engineering and precision machining are my two main passions, and luckily I have a job that lets me do both of those. So,
was there a point, Cyrus, where you realized you had become like a precision dude?
I don't know what a precision dude is necessarily. I know that I, you know, slowly just fell into the hobby, if you will, over time. Maybe I'll say a field, a little more official than a hobby. But I mean, it came from machining. I just enjoyed the really tight tolerance stuff. Rather primitively, I also just enjoyed shiny things, and those often go hand in hand. And through my quest to machine really shiny stuff, I also sort of fell into the engineering side of things, and that's how I got involved in the precision engineering field. And they're very closely interlinked, the machining and the engineering, when it gets down to those really, really small numbers.
And it felt like the culmination of all of those fields was this diamond turning project, diamond turning lathe project that you did. Maybe can you tell us a little bit about it in high level, and then I've got a few questions here about it that are more specific.
Yeah, sure. So it's a CNC lathe, fundamentally. Very simple, two axis. What makes it special is it's in the class of these ultra precision machines. The diamond turning lathes can machine parts, you know, with, instead of maybe tolerances of a few microns, you know, maybe it's 100 nanometers or something, a couple orders of magnitude better. And the finishes, because they use these monocrystalline diamond tools, are of an optical quality, or, you know, pretty much always better than 10 nanometers RA or something like that. And in order to make a machine like this, there's a lot of differences as compared to a traditional turning center. You've got a lot of air bearings, hydrostatic bearings, linear motors, very high resolution feedback sensors, and a lot of design considerations that go into making a stable machine that can, you know, in my case, move 2 nanometers at a time in discrete steps. The spindle has error motions of, you know, better than 15 nanometers. And the control of all that and coordination of the movement, it's there's a lot of tricky things that you need to consider there.
So my interest in this all was, A, what was the framework that allowed you to do this? Like, how understanding and supportive was the college and, you know, the staff at this college to allow this? It seems like a very large undertaking. And then what was the driver? Was the goal to have a diamond turning lathe, or were you trying to produce something with this diamond turning lathe and you didn't have one?
Yeah, so the driver was really just personal curiosity. Like I said, I got into it just because I wanted to make really high precision shiny stuff, and then eventually because, you know, I wanted to make optics for telescopes. When I started, it was all sort of, it was very nebulous. I think when I started building it, I didn't even know what a diamond turning lathe was technically. I just wanted to make a very high precision machine that could make shiny stuff, and then I sort of, it was a very long journey, and things changed along the way. What made it more official is when I started to try and get money for it and have some official backing, and that sort of lit a fire under me to get more serious about it and formalize it a bit more. What enabled it was where I worked during college, which was the makerspace at my university. I was one of the people in charge of the machine shop there, and we have a bunch of great, you know, facilities that not only allow us to use machines and teach people how to use machines, but also just have a general workspace where we can, you know, set up shop and work on a project there on a pretty long-term scale. So with the support of my boss, I had a little basically corner of the lab to myself, and as sort of on the side to my regular job, tried building this thing in the makerspace there, which is I was very grateful to be able to do, because that's sort of the point of the space, and it served as an example to other people to say like this is the whole point here. This is not, you know, something to just for classes to use and professors to teach in, but this is just for people who want to build stuff and need a place to build stuff.
Well, that's good that you're trying to inspire others with your project. I'm very inspired with it. It's not something I'm ever going to undertake, but I really liked watching your progress.
It always felt like I was learning something new, watching your videos and watching the progress, and seeing a peek behind the curtain and hearing you say that you didn't all like fundamentally know what a diamond turning machine was as you started building it exposes the reality that sometimes you need to be like almost too naive to attack a project of this scale and then learn as you go. And I think you did a really good job at documenting your learning through the project.
This is my takeaway from Cyrus's project and his ability to absorb new information. Yes. and takeaways. So he was grinding, I believe, is the X-axis stage, and is a large chunk of stainless. And you know, he's getting the results you typically get grinding stainless. And he sent me a message about it, and you know, I go, oh, sometimes silicon carbide cuts stainless a little nicer instead of plowing the material off, and you get a little better result. And I just know that as something that works, and I never really went too far. And he, of course, had to know why, and found that the aluminum oxide on your wheel and the chromium oxide that forms on the outside of stainless chemically interfere with one another, and that creates all kind of heat and dulling on your wheel. And that's kind of the difference, I guess, between an engineer and a machinist like myself, is I just, you know, accept the result and process. And, you know, it was very nice to like see somebody take my knowledge and figure out why it's, you know, an effective way of doing things.
Well, that's all very flattering, but I think Josh pointed out a good point that you really, you know, there was a lot of naivety involved. And I think if I had known what it would take, what it would have taken going into it, I probably never would have started it to begin with. I'm glad I put out that I look like I'm learning a bunch of stuff and have all this arcane knowledge that's necessary to do the job. But it really was just sort of stumbling through the books as I'm designing it and, you know, figuring it out as they go along. I think anyone can go out and build a diamond turning lathe if they really want to. It's certainly possible.
I think that's very inspiring, Cyrus, and you should be very happy with the result you've achieved. Let's talk about some technical specifications on the machine. Maybe you can give us a rundown on the key systems in a diamond turning lathe and how the design started and how it ended up.
Yeah, yeah. That's the stuff I like to talk about. It started with me trying to build my own spindle. The spindle's sort of the heart of the machine in a lot of ways. Without an accurate spindle, the best machine frame in the world won't produce parts that are round or flat or you know, accurate in whatever ways you need them to be. So tried building it myself, making graphite air bearings in the shop, inspired by that video from Applied Science a few years back that he released. That was sort of what kicked off that whole interest. And almost finished that spindle. I never ran any air motion tests on it, so I don't really know how accurate that would have been. It floated and spun. But luckily we got connected with Professional Instruments at one of the American Society for Precision Engineering meetings. And, you know, they were thankfully a fan of the project, and Dave is very nice and an awesome guy, and he said, you know what, I'll send you a spindle. Make the rest of the machine yourself, but don't bother with the spindle. Not in like a disrespectful way, but, you know, here's the spindle, and, you know, focus on making the rest good. But frankly, you know, we never could have produced a spindle as good as theirs. So the heart of it, a very high precision air bearing spindle. And then the axes themselves, the X axis is a hydrostatic axis, runs off 300 PSI oil, pumped to these bearing pads. It's a box way design. And that has a linear motor driving it with Heidenhain LIP 382 glass scale encoders providing positional feedback, and, you know, 2 nanometer feedback resolution and programming resolution as well. So it's really wild to see. You can actually see this axis move, you know, one strand of DNA at a time, you know, along the length. And do that repeatedly, which is crazy. Z-axis is similar, but it's actually an air-bearing stage. We didn't make that. That was a surplus stage that I think Seagate made back in the 70s or 80s or something. But, you know, it was on the shelf at PI, and they're like, here, play around with this. That's a real neat design with ceramic air-bearing pads and an anodized aluminum frame, which is pretty unique. But engineered a drive system for that. It's a friction bar drive, and again put the feedback on it so we can have it under tight servo control. And you know, with those two axes and the spindle, that's pretty much all you need. There's a flexure based tool post for really high precision tool height adjustment, and then those are all running off of some Granite Devices Ioni servo drives. But besides that, it's a pretty, again, fundamentally, it's pretty a simple machine. It's just a, you know, operating sort of on a different level, which can have a bunch of complicating factors that come along with that.
Did it join you in your move to Indiana?
Not currently. It's going to. So when I came up here in June, it just wasn't. It wasn't ready to move. It was. It's kind of a hassle to move, and I was moving, you know, the rest of my worldly belongings with me. So it was sort of, you know, pushed to the side, but in December I'm planning on going back and grabbing it and bringing it up here and I guess putting it in my apartment for now.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. Totally normal thing to do. I'm interning lathe in an apartment.
I always love the videos of probably like in Southeast Asia where they have these factories that are multi-level. It's like maybe 10 stories and each floor is like a 4-meter high-ceilinged factory space, and they're pallet jacking these like Precitech or Nanotech or whatever diamond turning lathes up on like the 8th floor of these buildings, and they're cutting like the most accurate iPhone lens molds ever on the 8th floor, and it's just a testament to their process and process capability and their engineers. But you can do the same, mate. You're in an apartment, and maybe that's the secret sauce we're all missing. You kind of have to be high up, maybe the atmosphere changes or some sort of barometric pressure. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to having to move that thing, that's for sure.
Okay, so let's. What brought you to Indiana, your new role?
Right. So, as I said, real small engineering company, ZS Instruments. A little bit of backstory about how I, you know, got connected with them. When I was on the Within Tolerance podcast, which I'm sure anyone who's listening to this knows Within Tolerance, I got a message from who I now know is the VP of engineering up here. And he said, "Hey, I heard your episode. It looks like you're doing some neat stuff. We just got a grant to work on this project that you may find interesting. Let me know if you want to talk more and learn more about it." And so I reached out. What they do up here, what we do, since I work here now, is we make encoders, linear and rotary, mostly linear. And what this new development is all about is the manufacture of the glass scales themselves. The ones, the pieces of glass that go in the overall encoder, like in the example of a Bridgeport DRO, you've got the aluminum extrusion, which makes up the structure of the thing, but inside the heart of the accuracy is this piece of glass that's glued in there, and that's got all your graduations on it. And so we recently got a grant from the NSF to develop this this manufacturing technology. And you know why that's special is right now, believe it or not, no one in America can make this glass. It's a capability that is not quite monopolized, but you know there's not a lot of people in the world who can make it. And among
just Joe in Germany,
yeah, a certain German company, that's for sure. And then. Especially that really high precision stuff. So, to get into a brief bit of technical detail, most glass scales are going to be of a pitch of 20 micron, and if you want, you know, higher resolutions, you can interpolate those 20 micron pitch gradients, and get finer resolution. But for the really fine resolution stuff, so say for example the encoders that I have on my diamond turning lathe, those have 2 nanometer. Resolution, and to interpolate a 20 micron pitch scale down to a 2 nanometer resolution would be kind of a futile effort. You maybe could, but it would not be accurate at all, because when you think about it, you're basically trying to subdivide this sinusoidal signal by, well, what, 1,000x basically, or 10,000x, yeah. So if you want really high resolution and really high accuracies, you need to go with a finer line width, a finer pitch on the scale. And so my job as a precision engineer is basically we're developing these machines to make these scales. And what that looks like is honestly a really similar process to the manufacture of computer chips and, you know, the ASML machines and wafer steppers and that sort of thing, because it's fundamentally very similar, where we're exposing this pattern that's very, very small down onto a glass scale. And then there's a lot of similar processes to, you know, coat the glass and etch it and make these patterns permanent on there. And yeah, so it's basically a wafer stepper that's optimized for one type of thing, which is printing lines very, very accurately on a very long piece of glass. We're working on machines to make scales up to 3 meters in length and pitches down to the sub-micron level rather than the 20-micron level. And there's a lot of other associated equipment, but my main project is really that stepper, is what I call it. And yeah, it's fun. It's sort of a full stack position where I'm doing a lot of the engineering, but also getting to build the thing as well, and it's been fun. It's good job.
So I'm very curious about industries or companies or professions that do like trailblazing work that's completely novel in a geographical region, for example, where they don't have the support of institutional knowledge or sort of like tribal knowledge. In your scenario where you'll be doing something completely unique, first time in the US, how do you go about researching the steps that are required to take and even finding out like the scope of the project? Is there a process behind learning?
That's a good question. You can pick up a lot of the elements of the process that you need to know from the semiconductor industry. Like I said, there's certainly a good bit of similarities. But if you're looking for someone to, you know, or if you're looking for a resource to learn, you know, the best way to make encoders, you're sort of out of luck. I think you could draw a parallel to, I remember you saying on a podcast once, you know, if you go out and ask the industry, you know, how do you make a watch? They're not going to tell you everything you need to know because they don't want to tell you, you know, all of the things that really matter most because that's their secret. And, you know, as with the case in many industries, that's, you know, that's kind of how it is here too. So you know the fundamental things, the fundamental steps, and, you know, you apply your precision machine design principles to those steps that you need to accomplish and, you know, basically work it out yourself. There's certainly not a book you can read on encoder manufacturing, but with everything we know combined all together and everyone's collective expertise, we're gonna give it a best effort and see if we can't pull it off. So
you'd mentioned you'd received a grant for this. Is there a push from the government to bring this kind of technology to be made in America? And what's behind that, I guess?
I think encoder technology specifically is a little too specific for the government to be like reaching out for it to be made in America. But the whole, you know, one of the motivating factors is, you know, say for defense applications, right? There's a lot of really, you know, high precision stuff that goes on there. And sometimes the sourcing is such that, you know, you can't buy your encoders from some of these, you know, overseas countries, or at least it would be better if you didn't. So there is a strategic advantage to having at least someone in America who can make these types of sensors, and there is a market segment there for it. But yeah, the grant we got was a SBIR from the NSF. Sort of specifically for this encoder project, and they realized that, you know, encoder technology is probably a good one to have in America, and, you know, we're in the phase two portion of it right now, and, you know, hopefully we can get some more. But yeah, I think there's an interest, but not specifically in encoders, from like no one up in Washington is like, we need encoders in America. But there is a general push, I would say, overall, to bring some technological capabilities back to America.
And more like a, not sales, but like end customer question, is there a market segment that you've identified where you want to be supplying these scales into?
It spans, a few of them. You know, there's sort of two, I'll say, classes of encoder market. There's the ones that we sell right now, which are, well, they're not low precision. These are high precision measuring devices, but they're sort of that 5 micron per meter accuracy grade. They're in, you know, that aluminum, extruded aluminum carrier, and those can be used for a wide range of things, from machine tools to custom manufacturing equipment, whatever you want to slap them on. But then there's an additional market for these ultra precision grade glass scales, which is what we're trying to make here. And those are more, say, OEMs and custom, you know, say research machines, universities, machines where you're using them in the exposed state, so like the exposed glass scale encoders where you're, you know, mounting just the glass on your custom axis you're designing or whatever it is. And it's sort of it's much more deeply integrated into the design process and more of an OEM context. But, you know, those also get used by, you know, people who aren't making products and just need them for, say, R&D purposes or whatever. There's a few different segments is the point.
From my perspective, I'm just like a machinist, right? I tinkle away in machines, and Adam, I'm sure, has got a lot more experience than I do, but fundamentally does the same thing. We're not engineers, and we interact with a lot of engineers, and it's very interesting to see projects that are headed up by engineers at this incredible technical level that the engineer also understands machining. Looking into the future of your career, what are your dream projects that you wish you could be involved in? That do they still combine this element of machining, or are they completely engineering focused?
Yeah, a dream project would sort of have, for me, would have to combine those two, because that's what I'm into, is those two things. That was the whole idea, or the whole reason the diamond turning lathe project was fun, is you're designing this precision machine, but then you also are the one who's responsible, you know, for going out and grinding the x-axis rail to be, you know, straight to a micron. So it's the whole process, and that's also, you know, part of the motivation of coming up here, is it's not a ginormous company. So you're getting sort of, like I said, that full stack experience where you're designing it, but then you're also gonna be responsible for the most high precision aspects of the manufacturing and assembly and alignment and testing and the whole deal. So that's going forward. You know, I don't know. I don't have like a specific machine where I'm like, oh, I'd love to go and build one of these one day. I'm not super dead set on any one industry, but it's definitely, whatever it is, it's something where I'm getting to do both. I don't really see that happening at a huge company. Maybe it's, you know, maybe one day it's my own company where I'm doing, you know, custom machine builds or something. I don't know what that looks like, but it's going to have to remain both. I need to run machines sometimes to stay happy.
So we're recording this in the end of October, and we've all just returned, well, not maybe just, but we've all returned from IMTS, and great fair from my perspective, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts were, guys, as we both, all three of us walked the fair, and maybe we can start with Adam. What was the highlight for IMTS?
You know, generally at these kind of shows, I walk past like the, you know, big name brands. I don't dip into Akuma or Mazak. I'm looking for the weird stuff, and we found it, I think. I got to see something for the first time, which was a running Micro 5. That was interesting. I've seen it for 6 years now, but this is, or 4 years now, this is the first time I've actually seen it cut. The Synova laser water jet, which we spoke about, that was, not only did we get to see it, you know, in person, but I found the sales staff to be quite communicative. Sometimes you get brushed off at these trade shows, but they were quite happy to talk about their product, and that was nice to engage with them. I'd say probably the Synova is one of the more interesting things I looked at that day. I didn't get quite as much time at the show as I wanted, but that one stood out. And then you?
You know what? My favorite part of the show was walking the grinding section with you, Adam. And it's actually quite funny. I'll tell the story to the audience and to Cyrus, I guess, as well, because he wasn't there yet. But we walk into this booth, and on the right hand side of the hall, there's Amada, and we chatted about Amada previously on the podcast, talking about the optical profile grinding machines. And here you have Adam, like walking in into this booth, and the sales guy, like, we're just hovering around the machine, and the sales guy comes by and he's like, oh, like, would you like to learn anything about the machine or something to that effect? And Adam, I could so see him. He just wanted to like offload all the information, but you were very, very tactful. And you just sort of said, oh, you know, I've seen these in the past and like interacted with them, blah, blah, blah. And you just started talking. And I think 5 to 10 minutes in, the sales guy realized that you probably knew more about the machine than he did. But it was a very interesting thing to like observe from a perspective of, I was just like there, and you were, yeah. So that was one of my favorite things to see at the show.
That was their digital projector model, which I'd never seen before. All the ones I'd seen were the old screen style projectors. It is an incredibly impressive machine, and I just wish like there was a way I could make money with one, but I just do not see the path forward. It's an amazing piece of technology, but the use case is very limited.
I really like the footprint. I mean, it fit into that sort of small machine vibe, but there was a lot of features in that. Just very, very compact, and it didn't have this like sprawling coolant tank that they thought of afterwards. It felt like quite semi-integrated. But yeah, so seeing you in the grinding section interact with your people was very, very interesting. but I was thoroughly impressed with some of the sample parts that were on the show from like the repeat offenders. So there was some incredible sample parts on the Kern booth. It was nice to see them in the flesh. I mean, in Australia, we don't get to interact with, you know, all these things that get posted on Instagram and until we go to shows. And, you know, Jim Toff is our closest show, and you don't have very many European exhibitors there. So seeing Kern's booth there was incredible, but also seeing Rota's booth, and Rota's had some fantastic test pieces and sample parts coming off their air bearing machines. And it was great to chat with those guys there, and they make a very compelling product too. Slightly different, maybe target market than what Kern is doing, but very similar type of machine. Yeah, there was some interesting wire EDM stuff at Makino. I chatted with Taylor, who I've known for a little bit, and he's one of the leads for the applications department, and he was guiding me through their new like UX3 machine, which is sort of like an American spec wire EDM machine in the 3 series. So it's like a 300-ish millimeter travel machine. But specified in a way that it's like a low option machine because all the necessary options are already on the machine. And compared to like my 2017, 2018, same 3 style machine, my U32J, there's a lot of advancement. And I was surprised to see so much in like 7-ish years, let's call it 6 or 7 years, to have like advanced between like wire threading technology, but also like processing technology for speed. Yeah, those are probably some of the big highlights from the show. Yeah. Cyrus, what about you?
Well, a lot of the same stuff. I also had an EDM thing written down as well, but not that one in particular. The demo that Mitsubishi had where they were cutting, like, it had to have been like a 20 or 24 inch throat in between the two heads. That was just unbelievable to see. And exposed as well. It wasn't a submerged cut. That was really neat. The Rotor's booth, like you said, you showed me some really neat demo parts there. Some of which I might go out on a limb and say were even more impressive than the Kern demo parts, from a shininess standpoint. Besides that, yeah, the Sonova booth was awesome. I've, you know, heard about these machines for many years, and it was cool to get to see what they're up to now, and really cool to see some of the demo parts. I know there's some videos floating around on the internet of some test cuts and whatnot, but I hadn't seen, you know, just how intricate and detailed of parts these things can create, which I guess makes sense with the kerf being as small as it is. But, you know, some of the like little like ceramic flexure type things that are, you know, these are parts that fit on your fingertip. And also five axis parts as well, because they had a five axis machine there, you know, little turbine blades, all cut out of like really hard materials. It was enlightening to get to see what they're up to. And then, yeah, it was a lot to take in, obviously, as my first IMTS. We were there as an exhibitor, but I luckily got some time to walk around. And there was, you know, a lot of impressive booths. The Fisher Spindle booth was actually neat, when they had like a 55-gallon drum of chips that was produced in 60 seconds on one of their like multi-hundred horsepower spindles. That was pretty cool. And, you know, we could go on all day, but those were the highlights. Actually, no, I've got a better one. At the Sonova booth. And you know this, where this is going. Adam's talking to the sales guy, and Josh and I are sort of, you know, in the background there. And I forget who brought it up, but one of us was like, you know, we're whispering to each other, you know, you should ask the sales guy about Evonesis. See what he thinks about Evonesis.
No. Let me jump in. I want to jump in. I specifically said to you, Cyrus, I said, I'll give you $100 if you mention Evonesis.
And I said, heck no, because I know these companies are not on speaking terms and in the midst of a fierce legal battle or whatever the heck's going on with them. And then, like, as we... Yeah, as we're joking about this, I overhear Adam being like, what's that other company that does the same thing? What's it like, Evonesis or something? And, you know, credit to the sales guy. He took it like a champ and explained the situation well. But it was funny that we were
both. I knew this too, but I couldn't help myself.
But my favorite part is that you lost out on $100. You could have earned it so easily.
That's what I go for. I want that intimate detail. I want the nitty-gritty, and I got it. I got to know all about the Evonesis lawsuit. So one booth I did forget to mention, Josh and I just kind of stumbled into the Supfina booth, and a very nice Swiss gentleman just kind of like, you know, lured us in and asked if we had any like super finishing needs, and we were like, no. But he kept us there somehow, and explained his product to us. And I never really fully digested the difference between super finishing and grinding. But it's basically just such a low speed application that the abrasive becomes extremely friable, and it, you know, you're just consuming an immense amount of abrasive. But the result is you can get very controlled finishes, and it was neat to have it like explained that intimately. And some of those booths like that don't get a lot of traffic, just foot traffic. Like the people going into them are customers generally, and they have very specific things to ask. And so you find a lot of the sales guys at those obscure booths have some free time, and wandering into them, you can occasionally learn some really interesting stuff.
Yeah, they had a very neat demo. The demo was like them sort of super finishing a bearing race, but it was like an ID bearing race, and mm-hmm. It was all very, very automated, obviously geared for mass production. But the results and the pamphlets and the sample parts were quite incredible. It looks like a polished surface, but they're controlling also the form as well with the process. So yeah, very, very impressive booth.
Now let's talk about the standout at the show.
Yeah, so I guess the standout of the show came from us stumbling across a booth run by a Japanese company called Shiba Ura. And this booth was quite something, because they had like a, I don't know, 3.5-4 meter tall, massive machine. I don't know what it was for, because I didn't really pay too much attention, but it was like some sort of big milling machine. And then they had this like little tucked away ultra precision machine all on the same booth.
The ultra precision machine could have sat on the table of the big horizontal mill that they brought to give you like an illustration of how different these machines were.
And as the three of us sort of stumbled across this booth, we started asking questions and digging into it a bit more and seeing the sample parts really like just exposed how amazing of a company Shibaura really is. And maybe Adam, Cyrus, you guys can chat about it and then I can talk a little bit about the history of the company and we'll go from there.
So I remember seeing this machine back when they were Toshiba. And like right around 2000, they kind of went to the Shibaura name, which was what they started out with. And they just kind of moved some things around in a corporate manner and went back to that name. But they have a pretty long legacy of ultra precision. They've been involved in the Japanese semiconductor markets for a long time. As Toshiba, they've built some diamond turning machines. They know nano precision, that it's something they're quite good at, but oddly it's a reaction to serve their other needs. They do LED molds and reflector molds, and it seems like they're building these machines to support the market that they're serving with their molding presses. And we see that trend a lot when we look at these companies. Like Amada, for example, might make a precision punch grinder to support their punching presses. They're not necessarily in the grinder market. They're in the pressing fabrication world. It's always curious when you see somebody become a world leader at something just to support what they're doing otherwise. It's not their primary interest.
That was sort of the curious thing that stood out to me was, you know, this is a true ultra-precision machine. I mean, some of these demo parts, you could see, like, I mean, they had a literal holographic part where depending on, you know, what angle you looked at it, you saw the part looked different. There was, like, an image of Mount Fuji, but then also Shibaura, if you looked at it the right way. I mean, it's almost more towards the diamond turning side of things than, like, a very high-precision mill, like a Kern or something. But typically, with those sorts of machines, that's all you see the company doing. It was interesting that, you know, they have this machine that's sort of on that nanometer level, but then you also, you know, they also make large gantry mills and injection molding machines and, you know, traditional horizontal machining centers. And it's weird to see that sort of hyper-specialized, you know, ultra-high-performance machine as just another part of a much larger portfolio. You know, you don't see that with Rotors or Kern or anyone like that.
So this is what I believe it's 23 inches or like, what is that, 600 millimeters of travel on X. It's not a small machine, but the thing I found impressive, I mean, it's like 200 kilogram table load on the smaller version, and then they have a larger travel version, I'll do 400. So, I mean, this can take a massive part. And it's, you know, supporting molds. And so that makes sense. But yeah, usually like when we're talking about diamond machining and ultra precision, it's small stuff, not things this, you know, bigger than my machine is wide. So it is really curious to see something that can produce parts that large, that precise.
Yeah. And you touched on something very interesting, Adam. This machine isn't making like individual high precision parts. I'm sure you could on a machine like this, but it's really catered to and designed around manufacturing very, very high precision molds or stamping tools, things that go into production equipment like we've just talked about that Shibaura or Toshiba as they previously were known also produces. So if you're making very, very high precision plastic parts, lenses or whatever it is, gears, you need a mold that has as much or more precision integrated into the mold. And how do you make that? Well, you need to have an ultra precise machine. Or really, that's like the end game. So there's other companies that touch on this concept of complete vertical integration, like Sotic, for example. And they'll give you a milling machine, a high precision milling machine, and a die sinking machine. And then they'll also make the plastic injection molding machine and so on. But with Shibaura, this is really like the end game. It doesn't get much more precise than this and vertically integrated as this. So there's some comparisons that we can draw. Like, for example, there was a company called Kugler. They still exist, but they don't make machines anymore. But they were a machine tool builder in this same sort of sphere, ultra high precision machines, like to the extent where they had aerostatic axes and an aerostatic spindle, and they would be making similar types of parts. But that's all they did. They just did machine tool building as well as some contract manufacturing on the side. Whereas what we see with this Japanese company is that they have a complete full stack vertical integration to the extent that they're manufacturing their own aerostatic spindles that go into the sort of UVM series. This is the milling machine that Adam was talking about that we saw at the fair. They make their own aerostatic spindle. They have like a full stack integration between like many other Japanese machine tool builders, they do the scraping and axis development, and they'll go so far to like describe the process to the customer as well. So the customer might be someone who just works in plastic and that's all they do. And they might have a job that requires them to make very, very precise plastic parts. Well, Shibaura will like completely develop the whole process for how to cut the part, which tools to use, how to measure the tool and how to offset the tool and so on and so on and so on. So really, really thoroughly impressive machine tool builder.
One thing that caught my eye, I don't know if you guys noticed, the control system, it's FANUC, but I always kind of, you know, go a little deeper. And I noticed they had the new HMI and the vertical panel. And I've not seen a ton of companies outside of FANUC integrate that into their machines yet, so I was really paying attention to it. And then I noticed they're running the 30i control. So like my machine, a lot of like five axis, which either are running FANUC nominally or running a face in front of FANUC, they're running the 31. And the 30, that's what you would use for like large, high number of axis systems, like some kind of custom automation or, you know, some kind of custom machine application. And so, like, it supports up to 16 simultaneous axes. And so I was really curious, what do they need this additional capacity over the 31? And so I got to probing the guy. And the machine we were looking at was a three-axis variant. And I was asking him about this, and he explained how they have a five-axis machine. And it's a little different configuration than, you know, most, but it's a C-axis platter that's on top of the table, which strokes in X, and then the head tilts in B. And so it kind of reminded me like those old Maho mold machines in that regard. Nice layout and probably really good for what they're trying to do with precision, but that's still only five-axis, and so I like kind of probing. And so apparently there's also, they're exploring jig grinding with these. And so I think maybe that's why they need the additional control capacity, maybe to like run a two-path system. But then I got to looking and, you know, they're maybe running their dressing motor off of that. But yeah, so we just saw like the most basic variant of this machine, and the five-axis and jig grinding configurations I think will be really interesting to learn more about.
One thing I found, one thing that sort of caught my eye was in the downloads section, there's a samples for car lighting PDF where you can see some of their basically demo parts. And they've got this automobile HUD mold, I guess, and it's a Stavax part. But it says it was the finishing tool was a single crystal diamond tool, and they're advertising a 7-nanometer RA roughness and a finishing time of 10 hours. So I'm presuming that's milled, but even if it was scribed, you know, sort of odd to see a steel part finished with a monocrystalline diamond tool. It's generally, you know, not advisable to do that because of the accompanying tool life issues that arise from the diamond sort of dissolving into the steel. So I'm just curious how they pulled this off. It's kind of a a point of technical interest there, where you kind of wonder, you know, I don't think that should be possible. How did they do that?
Does it say next to the example, because I don't have it here, but does it say anything about like ultrasonic or high frequency cutting?
That's where your mind would go, but I don't see anything about that. Maybe that's a secret option that you can add on to the machine, but yeah, kind of a curiosity there.
Well, also the time is very short. I've watched a lot of like demos of, you know, that kind of mold being cut, and 10 hours is like an order of magnitude shorter than those usually take. So that's kind of interesting that you found that, but it's a pretty serious machine. I'll be delighted to see more of these as, you know, time progresses on and what they're doing. But sometimes machines like these, you don't ever really see what they're doing. They just, you know, quietly get put into factories and support process.
I highly recommend everyone who's listening to jump onto their website and have a look through all of the data they have under their product information tab. So a lot of the information that we've gleaned comes from their website under nano processing system, and there's a whole slew of different things that they talk about and sort of describe. Lots of fantastic photos and a treasure trove of precision information.
All right, so it's time for the precision problems segment of the podcast, where every week, or, you know, let's be honest, it's not a week, we talk about a precision problem we've had in the shop and how we've solved it. I guess I'll go first here. I don't have anything super revolutionary, just a fun little solution I came up with a couple weeks ago, where we needed a precision adjustment screw. There's obviously a lot of things that can benefit from that in the machines we make, but I needed a quick and dirty way of making some very fine adjustments, let's say on the order of 0.1 micron or better. And there's a lot of different ways to accomplish this. Differential screws are often what a lot of people jump to, but if you just need something quick and dirty, what I threw together is a quarter 100 precision adjustment screw. You can buy these off McMaster, as well as several other suppliers, but these are the kind that you see in a lot of optical devices for adjustment. It's a crazy, crazy fine thread pitch. And you often get these with a brass nut. And sometimes they, you know, the fancy ones can have some adjustment to remove backlash, but oftentimes it's just, it's a brass nut. Nothing more to it. And even, you know, the best, when it comes to that fine of a thread pitch, it's extremely difficult to achieve a really precision thread fit when, you know, your thread depth might only be a few thou deep. And so those can be a little annoying to work with at times. So one thing you can do, which is fun, is swage lock fittings, or really you can use any compression fitting for this. A lot of those types of compression fittings you can buy a Teflon ferrule for. So the actual compression sleeve that goes around your tubing and squeezes it, often it's stainless or brass or what have you. But if you're using a compression fitting with a more sensitive or softer plastic tubing, you can get Teflon ferrules to squeeze down onto the pipe. And, you know, a quarter inch is a common pipe size, and these threads are quarter 100 threads. So what you can actually do is get a swage lock fitting with a Teflon ferrule, put your adjustment screw down into it just as if it was a piece of tubing, and then tighten the nut. And so you've not cut any threads into the Teflon portion, but when you tighten that compression fitting down, it squeezes the Teflon around the threads, and because the threads are so shallow, it just conforms to the shape, and it's not a huge amount of deformation to ask from the Teflon. So it's sort of a compliant polymer nut, if you will, and because of the way that you're doing it, where you're squeezing it around the screw, there's no backlash. It's sort of fit exactly to the thread profile. You accompany this with some nice CMD, extreme pressure lube number 3, that has a super high film strength. And even though you've got this sort of negative clearance situation on your thread, the combination of that very high film strength lubricant and a Teflon bearing material gives you an extremely precision feel, very smooth, very little stiction despite the positive squeeze on the screw, and the ability to adjust to those extremely fine increments, especially if you know, drive the screw with a larger Allen wrench handle or some larger lever arm. It's very, you know, if you want something more, say, sleek looking than that, you can probably come up with a custom solution with a Teflon taper and, you know, fully custom little compression sleeve thing. But for something quick and dirty, you know, a lot of, you know, companies will have swage lock fittings lying around, and you can pick up a ferrule and make a neat little adjustment mechanism that way. So that's what I got. I thought it was a neat solution to a problem. What do you guys have?
Well, first of all, that's a great little tip. I like that a lot. Having used a few of those adjusters, threading the shaft into the brass nut, so to speak, it's you have to have a very delicate feel. And so to avoid that altogether with your method, that's worth doing alone. So very cool. So my precision problem, I'm making some micro needle arrays for a biomedical company. And these very, very, very small needles, they're spaced every, I'll say sub 1 millimeter. I don't really want to give specifics on distance. They're like a cone shape. They have a very tight spacing. And so basically the tools I can get in between, I can do most of my work with a 0.3 millimeter end mill. And then I have to chase a little at the bottom with a 0.2. And so like anytime you do a needle type mold insert in a mill, there's kind of like a Swiss lathe approach where you use a bullnose end mill and you start at the top and you just spirally ramp the whole way down and, you know, produce the shape in one shot. You do have to do a little bit of roughing though, because that tool, as you think about it, as it's going down, it's going over into solid material. And like in the macro world, you know, end mills have a lot of flute, and that's not a problem. In micro tooling, they don't have much flute. They might have 1xd of flute. And so as that micro end mill ramped down this cone, it would be feeding into solid material on its shank. It would have no flute to cut it. So I did have to remove some of that stock first. And when I was doing the prototypes, they were all one-offs. And, you know, you get a roughing template that you like, and you just kind of apply it to your new part. And it's got some linking moves. It maybe helixes in here and there. And you accept that because the speed of programming is worth the trade-off of, you know, another half hour runtime. Well, now I have to make 96 of these pin arrays. And so taking the time to remove some roughing, there's not much I could do about the finishing. You know, that's kind of locked in based on step over values and the surface finish I need. But, you know, so any improvements I can make on cycle timer and the roughing, it's worth doing. And, I messed around with all kinds of options and strategies on roughing tool paths, and what I ended up with was just a simple 2D sketch. So these pins, they're arranged on like an iso grid, kind of 60 degree spacing, and the sketch is just kind of a zigzag line one direction, and it loops back around and it roughs zigzagging at a certain level, then steps down. And it does this, I think, 4 step downs, and in a couple minutes, it has the whole thing roughed out, just following this sketched line. Creating that sketch was a little annoying, But programming, it was one click, and it took a little bit more time than a 3D roughing toolpath to generate and, you know, come up with. But yeah, sometimes like on micro parts, standard macro toolpaths don't work great, and you need to really think about doing it another way. And that led me to problem two with these parts, which was file size, which this roughing strategy really reduced the file size. And, you know, we were kind of getting near the storage limit of my machine. And so to get that down a little was nice. And so, yeah, that's a problem a lot of guys I've talked to in micro machining kind of bring up is, you know, toolpaths aren't always the best for what we do and how we do it. And that's what I was dealing with this week.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think there's a lot of scenarios where you know what you want the tool to do, and getting Fusion or whatever CAM system you're using to output exactly what you want that tool to do is almost impossible. Yeah, maybe it's doing a transition here or a ramp instead of a plunge, and or a plunge instead of a ramp, and so on and so on. We've reverted to drawing a lot of the toolpaths, like you've just explained, but never in roughing. And that's an interesting thing that, like, I think that I really gravitate towards your precision problem, because the approach of telling the tool what you want it to do is so apparent in finishing, because you see the result on the part. But in roughing, you only see the result in the process. And so something like the time it takes, or maybe the result that it leaves for the finishing. So for, like, when did you, like, what motive, you said you have to now make 96 of these, but, like, was that the only motivator, just the time that it took, or was there something else you were seeing in the process?
Cycle time is a big thing, but, like, you know, I'm not cool enough to have a linear motor mill. I have to use ball screws still. When you see an end mill kind of helically bore into rough stock and then start, you know, 3D or machining it out, that's fine with, you know, normal size end mills. But when it's that helical bore toolpath might be a percentage of its diameter. Mm. And when the diameter is 0.2 millimeters, all of a sudden that helical bore pattern is trying to make, you know, just it doesn't seem like it's the best thing to do to your screws for 6 hours straight. Yeah, like when you look at roughing toolpaths in micro, it's just a lot of high speed reversal. And then you go to following a sketch and it's just kind of just smooth, just watching the machine and how consistently it stays near its active feed rate versus programmed feed rate. It seems like a smoother, faster way of doing things. So less linking moves, less lead ins, less jerkiness, I guess. All right. What was your precision problem, Josh?
We've got a job that's finally reached some level of volume where we are experiencing some new issues that we've maybe never seen before. And that's a culmination of things that are happening. Firstly, it's a grinding project. So we're grinding in our milling machine, and we're grinding carbide with a diamond wheel. And this job, it started off in quantities like 1 to maybe 10 to, and then to 25. And now we're at maybe 150 plus parts in one batch. And the basics of the job is we're really just grinding a V-block. It's a very fancy V-block. And I can't talk too much about the application publicly, but it's used as a V-block. And the faces of the Vs, the best way to conceptualize it is like the tip and tilt or the skew, the pitch of the yaw, basically where the V or the center axis of the V is pointing relative to the datums of the V block is very, very important. And the specification is 2 microns of, and it's a challenging specification to even put on a drawing, but it's a profile tolerance based around rotational axes. So it's pitch and yaw, where the V-block is in space in X, Y, Z is a bit less critical. There's about 50 microns of true position there, so plus or minus 25 against some datums. But the pitch in yaw is very, very important. And so traditionally, as we were grinding this, we're getting fantastic results. So the flatness of these two faces is sub-micron, and that's the nature of the method we're using. We're using like a cup wheel to generate these faces. So you, as long as your motion of your machine is fairly perpendicular to the axis of the spindle, with a cup wheel, you can generate a fairly flat plane. But verifying and doing the metrology on such a part is incredibly challenging. There's so many things that are happening at once. Like the condition of your datums is very, very important when you start talking about these types of tolerances. Datum against the surface is very, very important. And we were using a sine plate and an LVDT, like lever probe, to inspect and interrogate these surfaces. And the results, you need to like read the tea leaves a little bit to understand, like, if you're measuring maybe a change in the angle. So this is a 90 degree V block. If you're exactly bang on 90, or maybe your sine plate is off by like a fraction of a degree, like, is that your issue, or do you have an issue elsewhere? Now, the angle is far less critical. There's a relatively loose tolerance on the angle, but on a sine plate, you can't necessarily subtract that error out very easily. So as some of you may have seen, we purchased a CMM recently, and the CMM has been one of the ways we've been interrogating the position of these Vs. And now we're trying to understand if the CMM has the resolution and repeatability and, you know, ultimate accuracy to measure this much more challenging 2-micron specification for the pitch and yaw. And this is sort of at the limit of what a CMM is, firstly, spec'd as, and secondly, what you'd reasonably expect a CMM to measure. And now in this run of 150 parts, we've got some really good data, because we measure every part still on the surface plate with the LVDT and also on the CMM. So we've got this correlation between two data sets. And what I can say is that the CMM is possibly an order of magnitude more accurate than what the data sheet says. Data sheet specs it as a 2.4 micron machine. And in this specific measuring scenario, where it's a very, very small area. It's maybe like 5 square millimeters worth of surface that we're interrogating. But the results match an LVDT almost exactly. So we're saying maybe within a fraction of a micron. And that's given us a lot of confidence to trust the CMM in a scenario like this. And I was very impressed. It was one of those moments where you look back at a project and you look at the CapEx, you look at the training costs, you look at everything, and you do realize it probably was worth it. So yeah, that was my precision problem.
V-blocks keep finding their way into my life. And they're honestly probably one of the hardest things I make, like, for the reasons you said. The pitch and yaw of those two faces is it's a significant concern. And it's not an easy thing to handle in any regard, because you're all of a sudden dealing with a lot of things all at once. And they're a very innocent looking thing, but super challenging. And I have 3 big projects in the shop right now, and 2 of them are V-block related, and for whatever reason, they keep coming to me, so.
Thank you very much to listening to episode 20 of the Precision Microcast. This was a guest episode with Cyrus from Silo's Garage on Instagram. And if you'd like to keep up with Adam or I, you can follow us on our respective Instagrams, Adam the Machinist, as well as Adam's YouTube channel by the same name, and myself under NH Micro or Nicholas Hacko Watch. Thank you again for your time, and we look forward to seeing you in episode 21. Bye.